is not noon nor night, when over lactuousness yet all delight in all her words and all ears fit, you may at revels, you at council sit. If we love things long sought, age is a thing which we are 50 years in compassing. If transitory things which soon decay, age must be loveliest at the latest day. No spring nor summer beauty hath such grace as I have seen in one autumnal face.
By John Donne, set to music by Alec Roth. That was Autumnal, sung by Mark Patmore with the guitarist Morgan Szymanski. And if you missed last night's BBC Prom, given by the Berlin Radio Choir and Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, a remarkable performance of Bach's St. Matthew Passion, which featured Mark Patmore in the role of the evangelist. Well, as we heard a little earlier, every Prom is now available via the BBC Radio 3 website in high-definition sound for 30 days after broadcast, so do have a listen. I don't think you'll be disappointed. We're back at the Proms a little later this afternoon for the Proms debut of the Qatar Philharmonic Orchestra. That's at 3:30. Now, though, at 2:15, a little later than usual here on BBC Radio 3, the early music show is presented by Lucy Skeeping.
Welcome to the show and some music today, which, at the start anyway, isn't quite our usual fare. excitable, foot-tapping Odessa Bulgar performed by my own group, The Burning Bush. It's what's known as klezmer music, a word, and indeed a style, that was still pretty unfamiliar in the UK when I started exploring it back in the late 1980s. You could hear klezmer at Jewish weddings and bar mitzvahs, of course, and the beautiful score of that great blockbuster of a film, Fiddler on the Roof, certainly owes much of its inspiration to traditional klezmer melodies. But although the sound has certainly become better known in recent years, there's still some confusion about its origins. For a start, klezmer doesn't refer to Jewish traditional music in general, but specifically to that of the Yiddish-speaking world of Eastern Europe, the Ashkenazi or Germanic areas, rather than that of the Sephardim or Jews of Spanish origin. It originally described festive dance music and instrumental display pieces. It was sometimes called freilich music, literally happy music. A wedding without a klezmer is worse than a funeral without tears, it was said. And the players themselves were often itinerant entertainers who, lacking any formal training, passed the tunes around orally down the generations. Although, as we'll hear, a few of them were fortunate enough to become court musicians for the nobility. But those characteristic, almost oriental modes, the way a joyful, upbeat dance can suddenly become calm and contemplative or feature a phrase that seems to imitate the laugh or the sob of the human voice. Where does all that come from, and just how far back can it be traced? A few days ago, I chatted with Dr. Alex Knapp, who lectured at the University of London's School of Oriental and African Studies and who specialises in the field of Jewish music. And it seems we have to start in biblical times.
The roots of klezmer go back many, many centuries. There has always been a tradition of Jewish instrumental music, although it was somewhat frowned upon by the early rabbis, for the reason that there was a sense of mourning for the loss of the temple in Jerusalem, which was destroyed in 70 of the Common Era. That's the Second Temple. And so as a result of that, and the dispersal of the Jews from that region through all parts of the world, there was a feeling that one shouldn't really indulge in too much festivity. However, over a period of many centuries, these original prohibitions and this idea that instrumental music was not appropriate for a group of people in a state of mourning, these became not exactly forgotten, but relegated a little bit, because weddings always had to be celebrated with instruments, because it was a joyful event and you couldn't have weddings without instruments. And so gradually a style developed over a period of many centuries. And what we know as klezmer now really had its roots in North, East, Central and Western Europe in the Middle Ages. There's no way of dating precisely, but it started possibly around the 12th, 13th century and developed in different parts of Europe in different ways.
I mean, I was just thinking about any sort of documentation, because you mentioned the Middle Ages. Jews, as far as I know, must have been pretty well outcast, or at least at the bottom of the social pile at that time. So how could a travelling performer, say, have been, any of his music been preserved, or would it have been? Or did he simply play and perform music that was in general usage?
It's a very complicated picture, partly because, of course, klezmer music was, in the early days, never written down. This was an oral tradition. It was passed from father to son or daughter, because there were female klezmer musicians as well, even in the early days. But it was an oral tradition passed through dynasties of klezmer families. So it's very hard to tell, in terms of actual documentation, what the music sounded like, or indeed what were the routes that these various families took across Europe. Because, as you quite rightly say, of course, Jews are very often living a nomadic life, depending on persecutions and all sorts of other difficulties, political and social difficulties, which would make them welcome in some parts of Europe, but not in others, and this would change. So therefore, they picked up music along the way. Possibly the earliest roots of klezmer that one might be able to determine would be the music of the Jewish troubadours. And one of the most important of those was Süskind von Trimberg, who was born around 1220 in Bavaria, in the south of Germany. And he had a very large repertoire of songs that he composed. The texts have come down to us, but the actual music itself has not, because the music was not notated. However, there was a lot of music that was sung at the time by Christian troubadours, and these forms of music were actually very often applied to the Jewish texts and sung together. And this is something that goes back indeed to Temple times, this kind of idea of taking a religious or a secular text of Jewish content, but singing it to the music that was current in the wider world.
Musicologist Alex Knapp, and we'll hear one of Susskind's songs now. As you'll hear, the singer uses that poetic sort of freestyle of the troubadours, but this is no complaint of a forlorn lover. Rather, it seems, a comment on the suffering of all Jews in this period. I know not what to do to end all my pain and care. My children's tears flow bitterly. Their youth is hard indeed. Often they cannot find here the wherewithal to feed, so they can no longer recognise the face of any joy. But my house and larder are empty. My dear friends, help, free me from him who robs me.
Schafft mir Ungerecht. zwächet mich an Spiese, und auch an Wette. Ich verruf der Taren Fahrt mit meiner Künste zware, dass mir die Herren nicht Welt geben, dass ich erhofft will fliehen. Und will mir einen langen Bart, lang wachsen grieser Haare. Ich will in alte Juden leben, mich hinan fürwärts ziehen. Niemand, der soll wissen lang, tief und der reine Worte, dem täglich soll sie mein Gott. Und selten mag singen, o völligen Sang. Sieht mich die Herren scheiden von ihr.
Song from the 13th century. Hjalde Rebling, the singer, with lutenists Hans Werner Appel and Stefan Maas. Veit Heller played the portative organ and Michael Metzler percussion. I asked Alex just how much we know about its composer, Suskind von Trimberg.
He was based for a while at the court of the Bishop of Würzburg, and he would travel with his lute from one castle to another, entertaining the nobility with his poetry and with his songs. Unfortunately, he was never paid very much, although his audiences were actually very wealthy. And he composed melodies and verses in what was known at the time as Middle High German, a dialect of German that's not spoken nowadays, but actually forms the basis of Yiddish, which is the Jewish Ashkenazi main language. And his texts were very often philosophical and introspective, and often using texts that were connected with the Bible and with the Talmud, which are the rabbinical writings, commentaries on the Bible and on the liturgy.
We'll hear two more songs from Suskind now. But did he compose the music as well as writing the words?
No, the text was by Suskind von Trimberg, the Jewish troubadour, but the music, in the case of Schwer Adelichen Tod, was ascribed to Konrad von Würzburg, who lived round about the same time as Suskind, who was from the Christian community. So therefore this melody would quite possibly have been sung to Suskind's text at the time, as it is indeed in this reconstruction. Similarly, the next example, Gedenke, Niemann kann erwehren, the text was written by Suskind, but the actual melody was composed by Friedrich von Sonnenburg, who lived around about the same time as Suskind. And Friedrich von Sonnenburg was from the Christian community, and this melody has been preserved in notation as well.
Well, the text of the first song we'll hear seems to be aptly aimed at Suskind's aristocratic audience. Whoever acts in decency, I wish to call noble. One can no more recognise nobility from recorded lineage than the rose by the thorn. And where men violate virtue's duties, there the robes of nobility fall into mere pieces.
Sind's Adelsachtet nicht, geneimet sei. Kirche trat, der da den Jutet nimmer. Zwar adel Arkeit viel begat, er hauet Gott geziemer. Schamen, doch zwar sind selbes Ding, zum Besten kann gesamen, den heiß ich redels mir nicht, sie von Adel der Geborne.
Thoughts are free to move where they will. Nothing can keep them, neither stone nor steel nor iron. Thoughts are the possessions of man, as are the heart and mind. The text of the second of those two songs by the 13th century so-called Jewish troubadour Suskind von Trimberg. I asked Alex Knapp what documentation survives of these early songs.
Well, the earliest one that we can find is a notebook of a Jewish minstrel who was writing in the German language, but who actually wrote German in the Hebrew alphabet. This was found in 1382 in a collection, a treasure house, of manuscripts that was in a synagogue in Cairo. And it consisted of German epics, but also songs about Old Testament figures like Moses, Abraham, Joseph. And this document of 1382 is probably the oldest. There's another one from about the 14th century, a manuscript of Yiddish music, was called the Shmuelbuch, the Samuel book. And this also contained epics and biblical tales in many, many rhymed stanzas. And it existed only in manuscript and in oral tradition, in other words, passed on from one singer to another, until it was published in Augsburg in Germany in the middle of the 16th century.
And there was notation, actual scores in there, or was it just the text?
It appears to be that there was actual musical notation, and this is something very rare for Jewish music before about the middle of the 18th century, because Jewish music with very, very few and rather important exceptions, was actually a tradition that was passed on from father to son, mother to daughter, and, you know, teacher to pupil over the generations, but was not written down in any kind of what you might call Western notation. So Jewish musicians would sing poetry based on biblical subjects and Jewish liturgy, but also they would be in the language of the environment, in the vernacular. And this is how the Jewish forms of the various languages of the peoples among whom they lived actually developed. So Yiddish, which is the language of the Ashkenazi Jews, is actually a kind of Middle High German of medieval times. It's actually a German language, a Teutonic language, but as it was at that time, with the addition of many Hebrew words, Slavic words, and words from all different parts of Europe, blended into it. And indeed, it's a very fascinating way of looking at how German might in part have sounded several centuries ago.
But this sort of hybrid, as it were, that we find in the language that you've described also exists in the music and the text relationship, doesn't it? Because you've got this contrafactum idea. Tell us about that.
Ah, yes. Well, where you have these texts where we don't actually know what the melody was, what we do know, as far as the scholars of today have determined, is that many of the texts actually would have different local melodies attached to them. The melodies would very often have been composed by Christian counterparts of the Jewish troubadours, and then taken into the Jewish repertoire and sung according to these melodies that were known within the wider community. And that has been going on for many, many centuries.
Ihr Licht, ihr Löschert mich die Nacht. Ihr hohes Loch, mit Feuer.
a 13th century song in the form of a heartfelt prayer by Jewish troubadour Suskind von Trimberg. And the text reflects the state of mind, the sense of isolation endured by Jews throughout Europe in the Middle Ages. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Lucy's Keeping, and I'm looking back through the centuries to discover more about the roots of the Jewish traditional music style called klezmer. I asked Alex Knapp where the term comes from.
Klezmer comes from two Hebrew words which have been elided, and the words are klei zemer, and that means vessels of song, which is a rather picturesque way of talking about instruments. Klezmer really means instruments, effectively, in the Hebrew. So klezmer originally meant the instrument or instruments on which this kind of music was played. It then transferred its meaning to the people who played it, the klezmer musicians, and then to the kind of music that those musicians played on those instruments.
Which is sort of where we are in today's definition,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes. So klezmer was the singular, and they added a kind of Hebrew plural to it. They called them klezmorim. And this is the terminology that we use in the present day. And what they played was effectively a repertoire that was used mainly in Jewish weddings, because this was where this kind of lively, upbeat, joyful entertainment music was most required and created exactly the atmosphere. Even if people were living in deprived conditions, nevertheless, a wedding always had to be celebrated suitably, and celebrating a wedding suitably meant with instruments.
Thank you. The Burning Bush performing klezmer pieces for a wedding, the upbeat Von Taschlach, followed by Firen de Mechatonim. Alex, that second piece has got so much character, hasn't it?
Yes, this is actually one of the very important parts of the wedding ritual, where the parents-in-law are guided gently back home after the festivity because they may be very elderly or a little inebriated. And so there is a special dance, so to speak, which is used to characterise the guiding of the parents-in-law back to their home. Mechutonim means parents-in-law, basically.
That's a Yiddish word, is it?
It's a Yiddish word, but it's also from the Hebrew. And a lot of Yiddish does come from the Hebrew, although it's fundamentally a German language. Now, one of the interesting things about those two extracts would be the modality. In other words, the kind of melodies, the kind of phrases, and the kind of scales that this kind of music would actually use. The first one that we heard just now was in the Mishaberach mode, the equivalent of the Ukrainian Dorian scale. So very popular in Eastern Europe. It would be used by Roma musicians, it would be used quite widely, and it was very much absorbed by Jewish musicians as well. The second one was in the Fregish mode, which is a colloquial term for the Ahava Rabbah mode, also used in the synagogue by the cantor. And this is also very much connected with Arabic classical music. Although those kind of modes are very popular in the music of the synagogue and indeed the music of the klezmorim, it is one of the latest developments of Jewish music as a whole, entering into Jewish music around about the 10th or 11th century, which is actually quite new if you think of a music tradition that goes back 3.5 millennia. Nevertheless, these are the vehicles for some of the most poignant prayers in the synagogue and also some of the most characterful kinds of klezmer music as well, and would have been known to some extent by the early medieval singers of Jewish music, but it would not really have been very well established until some centuries later. So in other words, it's really from about the 12th, 13th, 14th century that these kind of modalities, these kinds of scales and phrases of music would have become part and parcel of the Jewish canon.
Alex Knapp. And we'll continue the wedding theme in this next set. The wonderful violinist Itzhak Perlman plays a doina, a Romanian-style piece improvised within given modes, which then goes into a lively and very virtuosic scotchna. First, though, a gentle song from the 18th century, Callalied, that wishes the young bride will give birth to a son in 9 months' time.
Jetzt wollen wir reden von Gottes Wort, was ihr uns geboten habt, von Anfang dieser Welt. Dieser Tag geschieht dir zu Ehren, Buße tun hat Gott.
The violinist Itzhak Perlman leading the band Brave Old World in the traditional Doina and Skotchna. And before that, we heard the singer Hjalda Rebling, lutenist Hans-Werner Appel and Stefan Maas, Veit Heller on portative organ and Michael Metzler percussion with Kalalied from the 18th century. So, klezmer musicians played an important part in wedding festivities, but where else might they perform?
All sorts of other events were celebrated with musical activity because of creating the right kind of atmosphere and the right kind of environment. There would have been commemorations of a new scroll, the building of a new synagogue, a circumcision ceremony.
Would Jewish musicians have ever played in the outside world, as it were, outside the ghetto?
Absolutely. They were very popular. Sometimes they were preferred to the Christian musicians of the environment simply because they tended not to involve themselves in drinking and other kind of activities which might prevent them from giving their best as musicians. And so, therefore, they were very often invited to play at Christian ceremonies, Christian weddings, and indeed the style of music that they used for that would be adapted to what was appropriate in a Christian context. So, in other words, they wouldn't have some of the traditional Jewish elements, but they would replace some of the Jewish dances with polkas, mazurkas, local folk songs, even hymns, ballads and street songs, and they would also perhaps even use light classical music that was popular, which was, you know, in the air, so to speak, that would have penetrated the ghetto walls, overtures, waltzes, all sorts of kinds of music that were more connected with the wider community outside of the ghetto and outside of the shtetl. And the shtetl was the small Jewish village in which many Jews would be living because they were constricted to those areas within certain areas of Eastern Europe known as the Pale of Settlement.
Thank you.
Tanzjiddelich, a traditional klezmer melody arranged and performed by the Burning Bush. Well, we've heard quite a variety of different interpretations of klezmer music so far, some with modern instruments, after all this was still very much a living tradition, others recreating earlier sounds and earlier textures. But as Alex explains, the typical klezmer lineup changed over the centuries.
It seems that the lute, certainly in medieval times, was a popular instrument for a klezmer musician, and they would also have bowed instruments such as violins and a viola da gamba or a cello, and it would just depend on who was around, who was able to play what instruments, but they did double on many instruments, so klezmer musicians were usually quite versatile. This would be in the early days. Indeed, in the 15th century, it's known that klezmer bands often had women musicians as well, which might be rather a surprise because the sexes were very much separated in terms of social activity, religious activity as well. But here in klezmer, in this kind of more secular environment, there were mixed bands as well. So the instruments at that time were effectively string instruments of one sort or another. A little later, another instrument was added, which was really quite characterful, and this was the hackbrett, which is the hammered dulcimer. This hammered dulcimer became a very popular part of the klezmer band, and it was only much later that wind instruments tended to be added.
Doesn't sound like a violin, but it is a violin, and my goodness, it has such a almost like a weeping quality at times, very reminiscent to me anyway of the sometimes style of a cantor in a synagogue. That's presumably sort of deliberate, is it?
Oh yes, I mean the two are very, very closely related, and it's one of the most important factors that differentiate klezmer from Roma music, because in Roma music you don't have exactly this kind of style. The cantor in the synagogue has developed a very, very specific idiom that involves all sorts of different, not only modalities which are connected to the environment, but certainly the way in which the voice is produced, the voice production, which does have a Middle Eastern feel to it, as well as European, it's blended, but also more particularly the ornamentation, the way in which the voice embellishes the melody. The clarinet, as we know, is an instrument that comes from the latter part of the 18th century, and so of course there weren't any before that. Brass instruments such as trumpets and trombones and such like were introduced, but again, more likely during the 19th century onwards. The really traditional klezmer ensemble would consist of string instruments, possibly with the addition of some percussion, maybe some drums of some sort or another, just to give it extra rhythmical impetus.
Thank you. two pieces, each of them entitled Judentanz from 16th century Germany, the first by Wolf Heckel and the second by Hans Neusiedler. Both are from early Christian sources, probably attempts to reproduce the characteristic melodies of the early Jewish minstrels in the ghettos. I'm Lucy Skeeping, and this is the Early Music Show, and I'm exploring today the origins of the traditional Jewish music style called klezmer. Well, as we've heard, klezmer music was generally not notated, usually because musicians had no knowledge of music theory and played by ear. They compensated with considerable musical imagination, though, an ability to absorb and assimilate, a great feeling for rhythm, and for exactly what their audience needed at any given moment. Nevertheless, when it came to the outside world, the world outside the ghettos and their own immediate community, it seems that Jewish musicians had to be quite ingenious at times. One story describes how a Polish klezmer, Yankel the Fiddler, was asked by a wealthy nobleman to bring his band to play at a grand ball. They must, however, be seen to be reading music from scores so they'd look like a proper professional group, he told them, or else they wouldn't be paid. Of course, neither Yankel nor any of his colleagues could actually read a note of music. But with what we might now call chutzpah, the next morning he purchased a set of music stands and collected some Hebrew prayer books from the synagogue, which he placed on the stands during the concert. "Is this your music?" asked one puzzled guest as he scrutinised the unfamiliar squiggles of the Hebrew. "Yes," replied Yankel, "our music is written in a secret code that only we klezmorim can read." Although the nobleman was apparently a bit suspicious, the story was accepted and the musicians got their fee. Whether or not any of that really happened, there's no doubt that earning a living as a klezmer musician could be extremely hard. They might be restricted as to when and where they could perform or in the size of the band. They might not be allowed to play beyond midnight or be heavily taxed. And we know of one particular incident in 17th century Prague when several times the city's Guild of Christian Musicians petitioned against their rivals. "The Jewish musicians corrupt and confuse the music," they complained. "They keep neither tempo nor time signature nor beat and mockingly deprive the noble and charming music of its esteemed dignity." Particularly hard to take, though, was the ban on performing on Sundays and holidays, a time when a lot of work could be had in the homes of people of high rank. An appeal to the Archbishop of Prague, however, eventually proved successful. The rule was removed and a festive procession of klezmer musicians took place, consisting, we're told, of 19 trumpets, 8 violins, 4 French horns, 4 timpani and 1 portable organ.
Oh,
So what sort of person would a traditional klezmer musician be? The sort of person you would have allowed your daughter to marry?
You're asking a very leading question. But in point of fact, the klezmer musicians, although they were regarded as absolutely essential for both Jewish and in some cases Christian festivities, were nevertheless regarded, like in many other parts of the world, as low class.
And musicians generally, actually, non-Jewish ones, often were bottom of the pile, you know. Indeed. They went in the back door with the washer-upper after the event.
Yes, exactly. Their status was low. They were very often very poor. They very often were unable to make ends meet any other way because music was one of the few professions that was open to Jews in the Middle Ages and indeed until quite recent centuries as well.
One thing we find with early music, often in this programme, you know, it's a question of having to look back, see what's survived and make some conjectures about interpretation and how it could have been. I suppose with a tradition like klezmer, we were quite lucky that it had really survived even the many trials and tribulations of the Jewish communities as they moved from country to country, particularly this great move from the Russian lands, Russian, Polish, the Pale of Settlement, into New York between the 19th and into the 20th century. A lot of musicians came, didn't they, right at the beginning of the recording era, which provided an awful lot of information for bands that were to become revivalist bands, if you like.
Yes. So from around the 1880s onwards, there were several huge great waves of Jews who travelled from Russia and different parts of Eastern Europe and settled in New York, and then from there travelled to other large cities such as Chicago and then the West Coast, etc., etc., and blended their musical styles with what actually existed in those great musical centres.
So with the mass Jewish immigration to the USA, klezmer underwent some really important changes. Clearly it was still the style of the East European folk music for weddings, but blended in with that were idioms such as jazz and ragtime. Certain klezmer musicians became very celebrated, many moving into the recording and film industry in the early to mid part of the 20th century. But of course, fashions in music come and go. So I asked Alex what happened next to bring us nearer our own time.
The style itself tended to become rather eclipsed by what existed in New York already. And so therefore, jazz became a favoured vehicle for Jewish musicians in the early mid part of the 20th century. Klezmer, I wouldn't say disappeared, but almost underwent a total eclipse until the revival, which took place in the USA in the 1970s and then in other parts of the Western world in the 1980s onwards. The klezmer revival was very popular in this country, and bands such as yours, the Burning Bush, actually was at the forefront of many of the ways in which the klezmer repertoire became recognised as a genre in its own right, and it is now very much a revived tradition. It never disappeared, but it was close.
And I, for one, am very pleased at the revival of interest in klezmer in the wider world. In the past decade or so, I've performed it everywhere from church festivals in the home counties to a nunnery in Thailand, not to mention Germany, where there's now an enormous respect for a style which is so much part of that country's history. But time's almost up. My thanks to Alexander Knapp. And we're going to end with a traditional Romanian fantasy. Jewish klezmer musicians often travelled and performed with Romani musicians since they occupied similar social strata, and they had a great influence on each other both musically and linguistically. This is one of the most popular of the revivalist klezmer bands, the American group The Klezmatics.
Thank you.
A traditional Romanian fantasy performed by the Klezmatics and ending the early music show for this week. The programme was presented by Lucy Skeeping and produced in Salford by Jenny Pitt. You'll find details of all of the music on the early music show pages of the BBC Radio 3 website. And next Sunday, the programme returns to its usual time of 2 o'clock, when Lucy Skeeping will be joined in the studio by the harpsichordist Martin Perkins to explore the music that 18th century audiences in Birmingham and the Midlands would have known.
The world's best orchestras are live at the BBC Proms. Franz Welser Mürst brings one of America's finest ensembles, the Cleveland Orchestra, to the Royal Albert Hall for 2 nights of music by Brahms, alongside new works by Jörg Wiedmann. This evening, they play Brahms' Academic Festival Overture alongside his First Symphony. And tomorrow, Brahms' Second Symphony is paired with his Tragic Overture. Join the audience in the Royal Albert Hall for 2 nights with Franz Welser Mürst and the Cleveland Orchestra. This evening at 7:30 and tomorrow at 7, live here on BBC Radio 3.
And after our live prom tonight, Revenge, Corruption and Murder. That's in Drama on 3. It's John Webster's 1612 play The White Devil, updated to the underworld of the 1950s. Drama on 3 is tonight at 9:45. And that's here on BBC Radio 3. We're broadcasting on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. It's now 3:30. Time to go live to the Royal Albert Hall for the first of today's proms. It's presented by Patrick Trelawney.
Hello. This afternoon, the last of our New World orchestras at the proms. And having heard debut appearances by orchestras from Singapore, Beijing, Istanbul and Melbourne, today the newest kid on the block, the Qatar Philharmonic, established in 2007. When Kurt Meister, former general manager of the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra, was given the task of creating an orchestra of international standards as quickly as possible. 30 different nationalities are reflected in the orchestra's lineup, and today we'll hear them come together to perform Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony, and they'll be joined by Denis Matsuev to play Rachmaninoff's Second Piano Concerto. And Hannah Chang, the orchestra's South Korean conductor, opens her programme with the European premiere of a work by Iranian-American composer Behzad Ranjbaran, Sunrise, the third movement of Seymour, an orchestral cycle inspired by the great Iranian poem the Shahnameh.
Shahnameh, or Book of Kings, is the longest epic poem ever written. It's 60,000 verses, 4 times longer than Iliad by Homer. And retells the ancient legends and history of Persia from several thousand years ago to 7th century. Sunrise is symbolic, meaning the boy that was left at the mountain of Alborz, and the Seymour, the legendary bird, found the boy because it was left by parents because he was albino, and they thought this is a curse. Finally, the father overcomes his fear and comes to pick up his son. And the sunrise refers to that the truth comes out, and he finds his courage to come back and regain his son.
Behzad Ranjbaran and Hannah Chang taking her place on the stage here in a packed Royal Albert Hall to conduct the Qatar Philharmonic Orchestra in The Sunrise from Seymour by Behzad Ranjbaran.